sacrificing a victim is obviously a good thing to do, but they are still going to have those feelings of guilt. Some people feel devastated in other ways. You know, I think romance scams are a particularly cruel type of fraud, because people at the end of that journey, you're left sort of heartbroken as well as having lost their money. And the money being reimbursed is a good thing, but it doesn't undo the other harm that it's caused to their mental health, unfortunately.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
The BBC News at 4 o'clock. This is Richard Lawson. President Biden has reiterated his calls for a ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah after the Iranian-backed group confirmed the death of Hassan Nasrallah in an airstrike. Speaking to reporters, Mr. Biden said the death of Hezbollah's leader was a measure of justice for his many victims, including hundreds of Americans during what he called a 40-year reign of terror. Well, from Washington, here's our correspondent, Jenny Kumar.
President Biden's comments reiterate his consistent message since the Gaza conflict began, that the US stands by Israel whilst also emphasising the need for a diplomatic solution. Mr. Biden said that the killing of Hassan Nasrallah was in response to Hezbollah's leader's decision to open up a northern front after the Hamas attack on October the 7th. Although there's a sense of growing tension in the White House over Israel's defiance, Mr. Biden stopped short of any criticism.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has described the killing of Hassan Nasrallah as a historic turning point and necessary to achieve Israel's war goals. Iran has declared a five-day period of mourning. Tehran also promised to avenge the death, stoking fears of escalation in the region. The Kent MP Rosie Duffield has resigned from the Labour Party because of what she called Sir Keir Starmer's cruel policies. In her resignation letter, she called the Prime Minister a hypocrite for accepting tens of thousands of pounds from donors while cutting winter fuel payments to most pensioners in England. She'll become the 14th independent MP sitting in the House of Commons. And Ms. Duffield told the BBC's Laura Kunzberg she was profoundly disappointed by Sir Keir.
We all had our faith in Keir Starmer and a Labour government, and I feel that voters and activists and MPs are being completely laughed at and completely taken for granted.
And Downing Street is yet to comment. Austria is voting in a general election today, which the far-right Freedom Party could win for the first time. It's narrowly ahead in the ruling Conservatives in the opinion polls, with the opposition Social Democrats in third. More now from our reporter Bethany Bell, who's in Vienna.
5 years ago, the Freedom Party crashed out of a previous coalition government because of a corruption scandal. But now, led by Herbert Kickl, it's within reach of a historic victory. Mr. Kickl has tapped into concerns about migration, rising prices and the war in Ukraine. He says he wants to be a people's chancellor. The Conservatives, led by Austria's current chancellor Karl Nehammer, are appealing to centrist voters.
And finally, Oasis are due to reveal more details on Monday after a cryptic message appeared on social media. The band posted photos of billboards featuring Noel and Liam Gallagher with a headline, "Be careful what you wish for." And that's the BBC News.
This weekend on BBC Radio 5 Live.
Today on 5 Live Premier League Sunday, there's live commentary of Ipswich versus Aston Villa at 2.
And the ball does find its way to the back of the net.
And Manchester United versus Tottenham at 4:30.
Five back in.
Live Sports.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
On digital radio.
On BBC Sounds.
And ask your smart speaker to play BBC Radio 5 Live.
Lisa McCormick.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
Good morning, this is Lisa McCormick with you till 5 this morning here on 5 Live. From 7 o'clock, Chris Warburton and Ellie Aldroyd are here with Sunday Breakfast, rounding up all of the big stories of the day, news and sport-wise. Now, before that, it's time to play one of the many podcasts we have for you on BBC Sounds. And mental health patients are among the most vulnerable in society, but services in England have been under huge strain for a while now, and sometimes with fatal consequences. A major public inquiry backed by the government is looking into the deaths of 2,000 mental health patients in Essex. The Lampard inquiry is expected to run until 2026, but what is its remit and what does it hope to achieve? Our colleagues on the Access All podcast have been hearing some of the so-called impact statements made by relatives of those who've died. And in this latest edition of the podcast, we'll also hear from competitors taking part in next month's Cybathlon. And we're going to hear about Chris McCausland's progress in this series of Strictly, and spoiler alert, he's doing very well. Here's Emma Tracy. This is Access All.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Goes up into a handstand in front of Chris and he plays her straight leg like a guitar. Then they take tiny running steps on the spot, rotating in quarter turns as they swing their arms up and round.
Oh, even listening to that back is such, it's kind of emotional and exciting. Did you see Chris McCausland, blind comedian, on Strictly at the weekend? Because I'm blind and I know nothing about dancing, so pretty much the same as Chris. And I'm absolutely fascinated as to how he managed to get through a routine on live television in front of an audience. My goodness. I mean, I know he found it tricky because here's what he said after his dance.
Chris, let's be honest, they love you. You did the cha-cha. What do you think of that dance?
It's absolute nonsense, isn't it? it's like someone's taken all, just sucked all the fun out of dancing and replaced it with terms and conditions. You gotta keep your legs straight, your toes out, your shoulders back, your arms straight. You've got to point your finger out like that for some reason. You've got to. It took me 2 weeks to do it with my mouth shut. I was like,
So, I'm going to talk to a blind ballroom dancer who has got experience. Hello, Marcia Bevan.
Hello.
Oh, lovely to have you on. Did you watch it on Saturday?
Yes, and just listening to that clip again, it made me smile. He summed it up really well there, you know, because you do have to, you know, move your legs and you've got to put your arm out and you've got to put your fingers in a certain way.
I've watched a couple of series of Strictly now, but I still didn't know about all those moves. As a ballroom dancer, how do you learn those moves?
It's a sort of a three-layered effect. So we are instructed about the steps first, no music. We then are counting the steps. So, for instance, the cha-cha sort of back step, one, two, three. So you're sort of layering up the information in your mind before you even get to the third point of having the music.
So you just build it up and build it up and build it up one little bit at a time. You've had dance teachers and dance partners who can see. What advice would you have for Diane for showing Chris the moves?
Well, it sounds to me like they're already building up a really good trusting relationship, which I think is key. But the clear verbal instruction, the willingness to show sort of using the body, you know, hands on hips, etc.
Yeah, so be very open to Chris touching the parts of her body that he needs to touch to learn what he needs to learn.
Yeah, within reason, obviously.
What would be a killer move or a killer thing to get right for Chris to really impress the judges?
The posture, your back, how it's straight, how your hips are moving when they need to, and they need to be not moving when they don't need to be.
That's interesting to me because I have not brilliant posture, and I know a lot of blind people struggle with posture because we kind of put our heads down to hear what's going on or our heads to the side. We don't look at other people and how straight their backs are and what way their shoulders are. And I know Chris could see before, but I actually am fascinated.
When you first do it, to be in hold, for instance, it's not particularly familiar. And this is where practice really, really helps.
Now, what would be your biggest worry for Chris McCausland in the Strictly competition? My biggest worry for him is that he's going to run out of blind jokes because he's gone in quite hard. There's this place for blind jokes. I'm not against them. I use them myself, but I only have a certain repertoire and I'm worried that he'll get to the end of his.
He's going to have a good repertoire of jokes. He will respond to the audience and he will just be himself. I think possibly it's all the information he's holding, trying to get it right and maintaining who he is.
Tell me, you performed in Blackpool. That must have been absolutely epic. But what would the advice be around like spatial awareness and stuff like that?
When it came down to it, just being on the floor, hearing the music, and we were familiar with the steps. And the last voice I heard actually when I went onto the floor was saying, whatever you do, enjoy it.
I am proud of who I am.
When I was younger, I was told I could be anything. being deaf. There's nothing wrong. It's such a joy to be deaf.
Me, live at the Apollo, Houston.
I'm on the autism spectrum, so I don't really care about social codes.
They're bringing into the question, should your child exist when he's just on the swings next to you?
Wouldn't it be great if everybody had someone to speak to when you could offload all of your week's grief?
This is, of course, Access All, the podcast from the BBC that delves deep into stories about disability and mental health. We do the very serious ones and the very silly and fun ones as well. So don't forget to subscribe to us on BBC Sounds. I'm Emma Tracy, and this time, just as you thought you'd seen every disability sport there was and every classification, in rolls the cybathlon. Disabled people and engineers pit their disability tech against each other, and one event sees disabled people see how fast they can move stuff around with their brains. We'll be talking to some of the medal hopefuls there. Very exciting. But first, for something completely different. You may have heard about a major inquiry that's underway into the deaths of 2,000 people in Essex who had mental health problems. They were either inpatients at specialist mental health units or had recently been discharged or refused a bed. It's known as the Lampard Inquiry, and the first few weeks have been devoted to impact statements from relatives of people whose deaths are being investigated. The inquiry is expected to run until 2026. The person leading the inquiry, Baroness Lampard, has said that by the time it has run its course, she may have recommendations to make to how the entire mental health system across England is being run. In a moment, we'll hear from a mother whose son died shortly after discharge from a mental health unit. But first, the BBC's Nikki Fox has been following the inquiry. Now, she's not our usual Nikki Fox that we have on this podcast. This Nikki Fox is the health correspondent for the East of England. And you've been following this inquiry a long time.
Mental health is something that I've regularly had to cover, especially the failures in Essex. There have been numerous reports over the years.
And what is this particular inquiry designed to find out?
Well, as you say, there have been more than 2,000 unexpected deaths regarding mental health patients in Essex over a period of 24 years. So this is looking at deaths right back from the year 2000 up to the end of last year. So some of the deaths are quite recent. And the reasoning behind it is to try and understand what happened to patients, mostly in mental health units, but some after they went back home. And they'll look at failures in detail. So everything from staffing to the technology used in the wards, whether there's too much focus on medication and not enough focus on therapy. And then they'll use that learning to make, as you say, these national recommendations for mental health care right across the country. Because even though this is focused in Essex, it is something that is a problem across the country.
And who will the inquiry be hearing from to find this all out?
Well, they'll be hearing from a total of 56 relatives, patients and staff to start with. They're called the core witnesses. But lots more people could be called when the evidence sessions start next year. This inquiry does have the power to make witnesses give evidence, particularly staff. So if they hear something during the inquiry that they want answers to, then legally they can actually call the staff that were working at the time to come and give evidence. Now, at the moment, relatives are telling the inquiry how the deaths of their loved ones has affected their lives. Next year, though, barristers will actually begin questioning witnesses and hear from the trust, the Mental Health Trust, that cares for these patients, and other NHS organisations as well.
And how do these types of inquiries conclude? Would there be prosecutions?
Well, there can be prosecutions. It depends whether the chair, Baroness Lampard, refers any of the matters to the police after this. So this is a chance really to look at everything in depth and find out how wrong things have really been going. So one of the things the inquiry is looking at is sexual safety on mental health wards. Particularly with this, the chair said that she would refer matters to the police if needed. She could also make a referral to the police on anything else she hears that she has concerns about. Now, police did drop a corporate manslaughter investigation into Essex Partnership University Trust, which is the trust that runs mental health services in Essex, back in 2018. At the time, it said the threshold for proof wasn't met. So there would need to be new evidence coming out of this inquiry. But as I say, they are bringing in a lot more witnesses than they may have previously spoken to.
Interesting. So why is the inquiry focused on Essex? Is there something particular about how the mental health services are run in Essex?
Well, it really is just the sheer determination and the campaigning of relatives and in Essex, just the family's quest for truth. It isn't run really any differently to mental health services elsewhere in the country, but there have been a series of failures. And it started with the deaths of two 20-year-old men. Their names were Ben Morris, who died in 2008, and Matthew Leahy, who died in 2012. Now, both were staying at this unit called the Linden Centre, and their deaths happened in circumstances that left lots and lots of unanswered questions. So their mothers joined together to campaign for answers, and the health and safety executive prosecuted the Mental Health Trust in Essex over 11 deaths, and they were fined £1.5 million. And what happened then is that families gathered more than 100,000 signatures to have these deaths debated in Parliament. So it really brought this issue in Essex to the forefront of politicians' minds. And then an inquiry was set up without full legal powers, but then hardly any staff came forwards to give evidence. So it really was a bit useless. And then it was made a full public inquiry, and that's now called the Lampard Inquiry, which has just started.
In a moment, we will be speaking to one of the mothers who spoke at the inquiry this week. Nikki, you've been there for all of it. How has it been following the proceedings?
It really has been quite difficult. I mean, on the first day that relatives began giving their opening statements, even the chair, Baroness Lampard, you could see she was wiping away tears from her face. As many as eight families a day have been telling the inquiry how, you know, they lost their loved ones and what kind of impact that's made on their lives. And what's really struck me is how those who died covered a complete cross-section of society. So there was a parish councillor, you know, a removal man. We've heard testimony from the parents of students, grandmothers, grandfathers. One was an author on economics. There were mothers with four children. And many of the families had pleaded for help and not received it. They thought a mental health unit was a place of safety. And one mother called mental health care hellish to its absolute stinking core. You know, the passion that came from them.
Difficult to listen to.
Yeah, it was really, really difficult to listen to because, you know, it really made them lose faith in the NHS, that they weren't getting the level of care that they thought that their loved one needed.
Nikki Fox, thank you so much for speaking to me. Earlier, I spoke to Julia Hopper. Her son, Chris Nota, died in 2020, aged 19. He had recently been discharged from a mental health unit in Essex and was living in a rehabilitation centre in Southend when he took his own life. Julia, thank you for joining me.
Hello, thank you.
You gave an impact statement to the inquiry on Monday. Let's hear a bit of that.
My son, Chris Nota, must be dead because I am sat here and I still just can't accept it. I have been devastated by the loss of my son and severely traumatised by the circumstances in which it took place. My suffering continues. I try to speak generally and not to speak about my family, my boys, because if I allow myself to feel anything, I will hit the floor and never get up. I know that nobody has our back.
That must have been quite a moment.
Yes, we've been waiting years to be able to speak publicly. We've been banging on doors for years, and the issues have been very severe. So, but you almost feel like you're freezing. You physically freeze because it's so important.
Can you tell me a bit about Chris and what happened to him?
Chris had classic autism, epilepsy, and an IQ of 58. So he was dealing with a great deal of challenges, and he may well have had other things going on. That's quite normal, that there are other things going on that parents don't know about in this country. So he had a great burden, and his lust for life was greater than anybody else's. His bravery, his commitment, and his kindness, because he knew how it felt to have to push harder, 10 times harder than anyone else, just to live a very basic, normal life. But that was good enough for him, and he was full of fun. He would have had you screaming with laughter. You couldn't have helped but loved him. Having him around just absolutely illuminated every space. But he had gotten into cannabis down at the park after school, unfortunately. And that certainly didn't help. It seems to be everywhere. Trying to deal with the stresses of life, using the wrong things, in the absence of any support or understanding. And then a triple bereavement and the COVID era. The very bizarre situation we all found ourselves in, which meant that we couldn't leave the home, really terrified him. He wondered what was going to come next. And he couldn't cope without being out and about, walking, moving, living. So he became psychotic. And over an 11-week period, he ricocheted in and out of hospital. Relentless, negligent discharges. And it was terrifying. Multiple attempts, both inside and outside.
Multiple attempts to take his life?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. What parts of his care, Julia, would you say were inadequate, that you felt were inadequate?
Absolutely everything. However, the highlights would be a wish not to understand or include his own autistic profile and the needs that might arise from that, and the kind of treatment he needed and his risk.
So they underestimated his risk, you think?
Yes. I don't think that's at all unusual. I think that's why we're losing so many.
Now, it was a very long fight to bring the inquiry about. Why do you think it took so long for the authorities to agree to it?
Mental health involves vulnerable people, epileptics, autistics, disabled people, and their lives are not valued. And in many ways, we have to be very, very careful that what we haven't done is actually dispose of these unwanted people who are not regarded as being people of value and equal. They are unique in that we don't have huge lobbies like the BAME or the LGBTQ communities do to try and get some semblance of equality and safety. Because many of us are vulnerable and don't leave our own homes or require carers to support us.
You find a whole network of relatives, and you're all part of a network, and you're all now involved with the inquiry. Now that the inquiry is happening, what is the mood within this group of relatives?
We are cautious and realistic. We know the inquiry has to truly deliver, because our phones ring off the hook with the parents of young people who are at high risk and are being failed in real time. And we have absolutely nothing that we can give them that can help them save the lives of their children.
What do you hope the inquiry will achieve?
Well, the only achievement for me, I know some want answers and that's absolutely fine, but the only achievement for me that will have any meaning over and above that, and in far higher priority to that, is that we stop. are children and young people being hurt for life, suffering, and in a great many cases dying. And we stop that. And so we will have to open every single Pandora's box fearlessly to do it. And we must.
Oh, Julia, thank you for joining me. And rest assured, we will be keeping an eye on the Lampard inquiry on Access All. It is the stuff of sci-fi, being able to move objects around without touching them, using just the power of thought. That's what a team from the University of Bath will be tapping into when they compete at this year's Cybathlon in Zurich. It's a competition which brings teams together from all over the world to fight it out in the field of assistive tech. The University of Bath team will be racing in the brain-computer interface category, and that's led by Professor of Neurotechnology Damien Coyle. Hi, Damien.
Hi, Emma.
And the pilot, the man doing the racing, is Owen Collum. Hi, Owen.
Hi, Emma. Hi.
Better go back to the beginning and find out what all this is about. Damien, tell me a bit more about what the Cybathlon actually is.
Cybathlon is an international competition where there's six different races. One of them might be a functional electrical stimulation bike race where you stimulate the muscles using technologies. Another one is an exoskeleton race where you wear robots on the external to your body to control legs or limbs. And so on. And we're competing in the brain-computer interface race where people like Owen with a spinal injury compete against each other in a virtual race that involves controlling or manipulating objects just by simply modulating brain activity. And the way we do that modulation of brain activity is normally ask the person to imagine movements. We pick up signals in the sensory motor area or the motor cortex. So whenever you imagine a right arm movement, for example, you'll get changes on the opposite side. You can detect those differences and then enable Owen to potentially move something or control something just by translating that signal into a control signal.
Tell me in simple terms, in a bit more detail, how the tech works, what the brain-computer interface actually is.
We would put a headset on and that headset will pick up electrical potentials in the brain, normally referred to as brain waves or electroencephalogram, EEG. And so when we put an electrode on the scalp non-invasively, we're picking up measurement of the activity in the brain.
Owen, what's the thing you wear? What does it look like?
It's just a general cap, and tight-fitting cap. It straps around your head, and we have sensors inside there for monitoring different areas of the brain. And then through a Bluetooth signal, those brain waves make their way back onto a computer for Atella and Damien to monitor.
What's the one that you came up with maybe, or that the competition came up with that you thought, oh yeah, that's a good one. That shows off our tech really well.
We've competed now in a number of years at the competition. So we started in 2015. In all those races, it was like a virtual track where you had to get to the end of the track the fastest. Basically, Owen would have told a virtual vehicle to turn left, turn right, or turn on the lights at a specific time and then have a no control state, which is nearly as difficult as actually controlling, where we want to continually monitor the brain, but we have to detect when Owen doesn't want to do a command as well, which is quite challenging. This is what causes a lot of challenges for the competitors in this competition and for the field of brain-computer interface in general. The brain is a very non-stationary, you know, it's continually changing. If you're a little bit fatigued or just had a coffee or a little bit stressed.
Tell me about it, Damien. Tell me about it.
Everything changes, yeah. This year, the competition has changed quite a bit where there's four different challenges. One of them is to drive a wheelchair through a virtual environment. Another is to select from a menu system of eight options. Another one is to move a nice or a cup into an ice dispenser, another one's to move a key into a keyhole. So that these are all things that we might associate with activities of daily living.
Yeah, it sounds like they've made them more sort of small, fine motory, you know, rather than just big sweeping things, Owen. Has that been a challenge to get more kind of intricate with it?
Yeah, I think the principle behind it, these devices in future will be for the home environment and probably available for everyone like yourselves and everyone to pop a cap on and imagine something and then fill up your cup, turn on the kettle, turn on the washing machine by thought and instead of using the Alexa or other devices that we are kind of mainstream at the moment. You would potentially you just think of something and it would happen instead.
Probably better than shouting at a speaker all day.
It would be.
What kind of preparation do you need to do to get really good at this?
I need to just imagine movement. So just imagine lifting my legs. Obviously, I have paralysis now, so I can't do it in reality. Whatever I'm doing, if I want to move the wheelchair right or left, I just imagine those thoughts and it goes in that direction, more or less. Sometimes I have a few crashes, but...
Yeah, psychologically weird to be saying, to imagining doing things that you can't physically do in reality. And it must be exhausting in general, moving stuff around with your brain.
It can be. It is a little bit tiring, especially when it doesn't work. And as Damien said, there's neurons shooting off everywhere in everyone's brains. With specifically when they get the tech right, it works really well. You can actually drive the wheelchair through the room some days with no error at all.
Damien, Owen talked a bit about how these technologies could be used in daily life for him. What's your aim? What can you see them being used for?
Well, like we started off with people who have spinal injury, but soon realized that movement-independent communication technology is not really going to benefit someone with a spinal injury that much because they can speak and they can do lots of control. But we work with people who have had severe brain injuries that have come through a coma and they could be in this state known as prolonged disorders of consciousness. And so first of all, we'd be using these technologies to determine if that person can hear us or has consciousness by asking them to imagine movements and then seeing if there's differences in the brain response in association with those instructions.
That's fascinating.
With the aim of maybe teaching them over time with auditory feedback in this case, because these people normally close their eyes during the experiment and so on. So we play sounds and they have to move the sounds. And the idea there is to, first of all, can it be used as an assessment tool, but can we establish a basic yes-no communication system with people like that? We've also worked in stroke rehabilitation where people engage the sensory motor areas again and do repetitive imagine movement, which activates areas that might help them regain lost function as a result of stroke.
Right, so very, very useful. Very useful.
Oh, for sure. Like, after a stroke, if you've lost upper limb control or hand control, then a physio will help you do repetitive movements. But if you're not engaged in that repetitive movement task, like you could be daydreaming, it's not going to be near as effective. Whereas with a brain-computer interface, if you've got an imagined movement detection, then the person has to engage the brain first. And then you can hook that to an exoskeleton or a functional electrical stimulation device that stimulates the hand and you get that full sensory motor loop there going. That's been shown to be really positive for stroke survivors.
Sort of brain physio, that's so interesting. Tell me, are you going to get a prize if you win or is it just kudos and that you can stick it to the other tech guys?
Yeah, I think there's a bit of that we can show, right? We've done really good innovations and won this international competition and you can get a gold medal or a silver medal, bronze medal. But it's much more than that for us, like in terms of driving innovation, like we've had to do some really advanced developments just to make sure that we can compete. In terms of the competition, it's raising awareness around the need for assistive technologies, rehabilitation and physical disabilities and so on. So,
yeah.
So there's lots of wins for us in terms of competing in this competition, even if we didn't actually win the event.
We're talking about wearing the cap. Then we've got Elon Musk and the brain implants, which end up with a similar job, you can move things around by thinking about them. Which do you think we'll see in the future? Do you think it'll be more brain implants or more CAPs?
So in terms of Neuralink and invasive and implantable technologies, these are seeing major advances in recent years. The evidence so far is limited in terms of what Neuralink has done, but the few patients that have these implanted, and the reports show that it's controlling things quite well after, you know, a few weeks of training, which is really positive. The implantable nature of it makes it a bit more risky, and it's limited to people that really want to go through a surgery. But again, seemingly the Neuralink technology is implantable in one day, and the patient can leave the next day. So it seems to be, you know, it's innovation in that area has been dramatic as well, in terms of being able to sew nano threads into the cortex. So that's why we focus on non-invasive. I think it'll be a while before, you know, everybody's able to get an implant, able to afford it, and it's going to take some time before that technology comes online. However, with implantable technology, you do have a little less noise that makes non-invasive technology a little less robust as well sometimes. But interestingly, at the Cybathlon competition this year, there is one team that has an implanted technology, and we'll be competing against them. So we'll be going head to head to see how well that goes.
Head to head, I get it. Yeah. Very good, very good. So they're doing the same race as you, but with an implant.
Yeah.
That's the University of Pittsburgh team.
Pittsburgh,
America.
Right. Well, let's see what happens. Good luck to Damien and to Owen. Thank you so much for joining me and attempting to get the information into my little head. You can watch a live stream of Owen strutting his stuff at the Cybathlon in Zurich from the 25th of October. Thanks so much to everyone who got in touch with us recently. Your messages mean a lot. They make the entire team happy. So you are, in fact, providing a very important service. Please keep it up. Like Emily, who said she enjoyed our Paralympics episodes. Yay! Emily says, I can't watch TV, especially the exciting stuff. So this has been a really nice way to still be able to connect with the Paralympics. And that's exactly what we wanted, Emily. We wanted to bring the drama and the joy without getting into the sport too much. Of course, the sport's important too. Of course it is. Absolutely is. Definitely is. Emily has also asked if we can put a link to the transcript in the description of each episode. Can we do that, team? Can we do that? We are going to see what we can do there. But if you want to search for old transcripts, go onto your search engine, pop in BBC Sounds, Access All, some words relating to the episode you want and the word transcript, and it should come up fairly near the top. Complicated? Yes, slightly, but I know you can do it. Honestly, we know loads of you read the transcripts. So thank you very much for mentioning that, Emily. Do like Emily, please, and get your messages into us. There are loads and loads of ways of doing it. You can email accessall@bbc.co.uk. You can go onto X, formerly known as Twitter, or Instagram, and look for us at BBC Access All. Or you can send us a WhatsApp. You can send a voice message or a text message to 0330 123 9480. Just put the word access before your message, so it makes it easier for us to find. Now, you might have heard me pop up on In Touch on Radio 4. It's the programme about being blind or visually impaired. I was talking about one of my favourite subjects, wild swimming, or I mean cold water dipping, which is kind of more what I do. Also pretty fair weather as well. It's mostly summertime when I do it. Anyway, here's a clip of that.
Oh, there you go.
Now, you will hear a lot of noises from me.
So it's about 10 metres high. You can hear the water probably lapping either side of it.
Very cool.
And we're looking right across to Edinburgh. Got some little boats in the near distance.
It's really cold. I'll probably get down quite quickly.
You can do it.
Okay. I'm going to do it. Literally just for Radio 4.
There you go. That's Emma in the water, swimming.
It's the balls. I literally can't catch my breath.
If you want to hear more of me shrieking, apparently there's quite a lot of it in there, you can find In Touch on BBC Sounds. And as it happens, you can subscribe to us on BBC Sounds. Please do that. Catch you next week. Bye.
The latest episode there of Access All. And don't forget, you can access all of the episodes, get what I did there, on BBC Sounds. It is 20 minutes away from 5:09.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Now, your headlines for Sunday morning. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the killing of the Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah has, in his words, settled the score. He described his death in an Israeli airstrike in Beirut on Friday as a historic turning point. Iran, which is a key ally of Hezbollah, has called for an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council. President Biden's repeated his call for a ceasefire. The MP for Canterbury, Rosie Duffield, has resigned from the Labour Party, describing some of the government's policies as cruel. In a resignation letter, she criticises the Prime Minister for accepting gifts from donors while cutting winter fuel payments from millions of pensioners. There's been no comment from Downing Street. The Conservatives, meanwhile, are gathering in Birmingham for their annual conference. The four remaining contenders for the party leadership will each get a chance to make their pitch before Tory MPs decide which two will make it through to the final ballot. More than 60 people have died in Nepal after torrential rain triggered widespread flooding. Rescuers have saved around 1,000 people, but many are still unaccounted for after landslides swept away homes. And the King has addressed the Scottish Parliament to mark the 25th anniversary of its formation under devolution. Speaking to MSPs in the main debating chamber at Holyrood, King Charles said its creation had been a turning point for the nation. With the sport now, here's John Wilkinson.
Liverpool topped the Premier League by a point from Manchester City and Arsenal. Arne Slot's side made it 5 wins out of 6 in the league with a 2-1 victory at Wolves. City were held to a 1-0 draw at Newcastle. Arsenal needed 2 stoppage time goals to beat Leicester 4-2. Cole Palmer scored 4 times in the first half of Chelsea's 4-2 win over Brighton. Everton got the first league win of their season, beating Crystal Palace. Brentford and West Ham drew 1-1. Fulham were 1-0 winners at Nottingham Forest. Amongst the Scottish Premiership games, Celtic are back on top of the table. The defending champions won 6-0 at St Johnstone to replace Aberdeen, who had earlier beat Dundee 2-1. Rugby Union's world champions South Africa have won their first rugby championship since 2019, beating Argentina by 48-7. In the Premiership, there were wins for Harlequins, Northampton Saints and Saracens, whilst Cardiff won at Scarlets and Ospreys beat Stormers amongst the United Rugby Championship games. Dame Sarah Storey has added to her collection of global titles with victory in the women's C5 road race in Zurich. She'd also won last weekend's C4-C5 individual time trial. It is the 10th time she's done the double at the Road and Paracycling World Championships. Lancashire have been relegated to Division 2 of Cricket's County Championship. Yorkshire have been promoted. Warrington Wolves are into Super League's playoff semi-finals after scoring a drop goal in Golden Point extra time to beat St Helens. And Terry Harper is the new WBO World Lightweight Champion. She's beaten fellow Englishwoman Rhiannon Dixon in Sheffield.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK. On digital radio.
On BBC Sounds.
And ask your smart speaker to play BBC Radio 5 Live.
Good morning all. Saturday's sunny skies will sadly be replaced by quite a lot of cloud around today and for some, increasingly wet and windy. That's because there's an area of low pressure moving in from the southwest. So as we go through the morning after a relatively sunny start, quite a lot of cloud spilling in, and by the middle part of the afternoon there'll be some rain and strengthening gale force winds across southwest England and South Wales. Ahead of it, a few scattered showers, and these will move across the Channel Coast and up into the Midlands. So southeast England and East Anglia will stay rather cloudy but dry into the afternoon. Top temperatures here generally between 12 and 14 degrees. Northern England will stay dry, northeast England the best of any sunshine, and for Scotland and Northern Ireland, after a chilly start, some sunny spells, clinging on to some sunshine perhaps across eastern Scotland, but clouding over with a few scattered showers further north and west. Highs of 11 to 13 degrees. As we move through Sunday evening and into Monday, that low pressure will continue to push its way northwards. It's going to bring some heavy rain at times, gale force gusts of winds across northern southern England and only slowly brightening up in the southwest later on in the day on Monday. But for Scotland and Northern Ireland, again, we keep some drier weather with a few scattered showers in the west. Highs generally of 12 to 15 degrees. Louise Lear, 5 Live Weather.
I have more diamonds than the Queen of England.
Welcome to the world of thieves and hoaxers and con women.
She does sound fabulous, though.
Massive dogs, lots of cars.
But who are these lady swindlers? And did they get away with their frauds and deceptions by using their feminine characteristics?
I am the notorious Tilly Devine.
She's a bit of a one-off, really.
Lady Swindlers with Lucy Worsley.
Where true crime meets history.
Listen first on BBC Sounds.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK. Lisa McCormick.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Thank you for all your calls and texts this morning about scams, about times when you have fallen victim to a scam, or you've realised that it's a scam and you've managed to sidestep it. We heard from Jo in Nantwich. She fell foul of a fraudster who she met online dating.
Well, he'd either copied my credit card, or I don't know how he'd done it, but yeah. Again, you could see by my records, because I was spending in Manchester, mm-hmm. and then half an hour later I was spending in Edinburgh or Glasgow or wherever. So mm-hmm. I was saying, like, I can't be doing that. And they were going, well, you must have given him your PIN details. And I said, well, no, I haven't. No. But I did date him. He could have been stood behind me and got that. Well, how has he got a chip and PIN? I said, well, I don't know. But he's created a card. You know, you yeah. tell me how he's doing it. Goodness. And then they were saying, he can't be doing it. I'm like, well, he is doing it.
How long did you date him for?
Only about 3 months at the most.
Goodness, right, OK.
Because he was in Scotland, you see. And yeah. So it's, but he came down on the way to Owen. He's a semi-professional golfer.
Right.
I could tell you his name, which I did tell one of the producers' name, but I don't think I'm allowed probably to tell his name.
Let's not go down that road just in case.
Exactly. But, but he had a very unusual name, put it that way, so I don't even know whether that was true. So
goodness, really. Did you confront him about it?
No, because he deleted everything, so I didn't have his contact details, I didn't have his parents' contact details, I didn't have an address, I didn't have anything. Because he got into my phone records and deleted all of that, which they can do. It's more obvious now because we all do it, don't we? We update onto our computers. But I didn't, 8 years ago, I didn't know that that could be done.
Yeah.
But he did. And again, the police were saying, no, we can't do that. Well, now the police wouldn't say that because everyone can do it. Yeah.
And how long ago did you say that was?
About 8 years ago.
Right, okay, so yeah, in terms of online technology, I guess we understand.
Well, we're all more savvy, aren't we? But obviously, he was savvy because that was his business. He was self-employed. Well, he was part-time golf pro and part-time web designer.
Well, that's Joe there warning us all to be aware of dating scams. Well, thank you for all your calls tonight about the realities of being a carer. So Michael Palin has said that he regrets leaving his late wife Helen at home while she was unwell to make his travel programmes. She died after developing kidney failure in May 2023. They'd been married for 57 years. So Michael's said that being away to make programmes like his visit to North Korea in 2018 were more difficult for his wife. He says in this interview, Helen was then less well, less good at looking after herself, unfortunately, and that was a slightly difficult time. He goes on to say, I don't think she particularly wanted me to go away then, but she knew that my interest in travel and other people was very deep-seated. It wasn't because I wanted to get away from home. It wasn't that at all. Well, he's released a new book. It's called There and Back, where he says that documenting events in his diaries helped him cope with dealing with the emotional toll on his wife's health issues. Well, Emily Holzhausen is Director of Policy and Public Affairs at Carers UK. They're a charity that aim to support and advocate for the UK's 5.7 million carers. And I asked Emily how common it is for carers to feel guilty about taking time away from their responsibilities.
Yes, it can be. It's very, very common. I mean, we find that people who are caring for older, ill and disabled relatives very often put themselves at the back of the queue, and they feel guilty about taking time off and time away. I mean, they even put off medical treatment as well. We have quite a significant number, you know, people in very, you know, physical health, but also mental health as well, where people feel they're just too busy caring to take time off. And yet, it's really important not to feel guilty about taking a break, because it's about looking after yourself and your own health and well-being. And that's always our advice to unpaid carers. But it can feel very difficult for on precarious to think that way sometimes, because some of them are carrying 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and feel very, and indeed are responsible for someone.
Yeah, yeah. But obviously, you know, the flip side of that is if they don't take any time away, then they're not going to help themselves or that person, because they'll make themselves ill. So it must be quite a balancing act, to be honest, Emily, to try and find that balance between looking after that person, but also looking after yourself.
Absolutely. I mean, it's really difficult as well, because we have a shortage of breaks. So we have a shortage of really good care in this country. There simply isn't enough social care to go round, and a shortage of palliative care for people towards the end of life. So, you know, making that decision is made even harder if you haven't got family, or family can't do it locally, and you have to buy in services or indeed rely on the state, the local authority, to provide that for you. So the first hurdle is feeling that you can. The second is trusting the care of the person that you care for to someone else. And the third, of course, is the availability and affordability of those services. So, but we'd always say, you know, find out about your rights and entitlements, because there are some really great services out there. And there are some very good local carer services where people can talk this through with others who've been in exactly that same situation. And nationally, we run a care for a couple where carers quite often share their different stories and are very honest, actually, about some of these challenges.
Yeah. I guess by the very nature of it, Emily, as well, you might not even realise that somebody's really struggling, and until it's really, really, really late.
That's right. I mean, most people start, you know, sometimes caring can be extremely gradual as somebody starts to their condition gets worse over time. And for others, it can be very sudden overnight, you know, with a stroke or a heart attack and somebody being discharged from hospital. But people see themselves primarily as their relationship. So sister, son, daughter, brother, good neighbour, sometimes quite a lot of neighbours support people as well, and very close friend. And they don't necessarily use the label of I'm a carer, I'm an unpaid carer. And people could take on average 2 years to recognise they're an unpaid carer. Wow. Quite often don't think about themselves in that role and don't necessarily find out about their rights and entitlements, and can miss out on sometimes financial support. They might not look up their rights at work, and they do have rights at work to take time off, either in emergencies or up to 5 days of unpaid carer's leave, or indeed practical support that gives them a break. So some local authorities, for example, provide breaks which carers don't have to pay for, which is really, really important for their health and well-being. And we do know that carers are much more likely to be in poor health themselves, both mental health and physical health. So it's really important that people find out about their rights and entitlements and take the breaks that they need. After all, if carers don't look after themselves and their well-being, when their health and well-being breaks down, if they can no longer care, then potentially we're caring for two people instead of one. And you know, that can be a tragedy for the family and the individuals, but it's also, you know, as well, it's increased costs for the state.
Yeah. Emily, I feel that when we talk about carers, we almost just assume that it's people later in life, but actually carers can be any age, can't they?
Absolutely. I mean, there are between 800,000 and a million young carers as well. You know, some of those might have lower end caring responsibilities, but some of them are providing very significant amounts of care. So it can happen to any of us at any age. You are more likely to care if you are older, if you're aged sort of 50 to 64, one in four of that age group, one in four women of that age group is an unpaid carer, most commonly caring for parents, but equally it can be for partners or for adult sons and daughters.
Yeah. If somebody was struggling and you know, maybe they were ready to admit that, I mean, what sort of support is out there? How would they chase that sort of support?
Well, there's some really great support. So the first thing is absolutely don't feel guilty. And you'll find when you connect with others who have caring responsibilities that you are certainly not alone. There are very many people who have experienced similar situations, feelings as yourself. And sometimes it'd be quite good to share that. So you've got a variety of possibilities. We have an online carers forum. So if you prefer that kind of environment online, which of course runs 24 hours a day, there's usually someone on there any time of the day and night. And it's moderated by carers as well. We do regular online sessions to learn new skills or share experiences called Care for a Couple or Share and Learn. And then locally, there are local carers organisations up and down the country. Some are condition specific, like for dementia or motor neuron disease or MS. And others are just for carers of all ages. And of course, Age UK is a great source of information and advice. So if you go to Carers UK's website, we've got a whole host of information, or we have a helpline that people could call, and I can give that number out if that's helpful.
Absolutely, it would be, Emily, if you've got it to hand there.
I do indeed. It's 0808 808 7777. So that's Carers UK's helpline. I'll just repeat that. That's 0808 808 7777. And our website is caresuk.org.
And I guess the key message, Emily, is that don't feel guilty, because it's absolutely a normal reaction to have, but you shouldn't feel it.
Absolutely. The first step you need to do is really reach out and connect. And then there's a whole host of information and advice out there for you and people ready to connect and support.
Emily, I'm sure there's at least one person listening. I say this when I speak to somebody like yourself that will benefit from the information you've shared with us. So thank you so much. But I'm not going to keep you any longer because I know you have some celebrating to do. You received a CBE earlier this week. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. I was really, really honoured to receive that. I have met so many fantastic people and worked with so many people who were affected by caring over the years. And it's been an honour and it's been incredibly important to bring their voices and experiences to the fore so that we really get the change that families need in their lives. It's needed more than ever, really, with
Absolutely.
Our ageing population.
Absolutely. Emily, congratulations again, and thank you for taking the time to speak to us.
Thank you ever so much. Thank you.
And that number you heard from Emily there, 0808 808 7777. And don't forget, you can get more sources of information and support via the BBC Action Line pages as well. Well, that's almost all from me for tonight. Thank you so much to the team, to Lewis and David in the studio, to Jack working overtime taking your calls. He's been absolutely amazing. And of course, to you for your calls and your texts. Thank you, thank you, thank you. We're going to play you out this morning with a song for Zoe in Northampton. And this is The Carpenters with The Top of the World. See you next week. Have a good one.
Such a feeling's coming over me. There is wonder in most everything I see. Not a cloud in the sky, got the sun in my eyes, and I won't be surprised if it's a dream. Everything I want the world to be is now coming true, especially for telling me that things are not is a pleasing sense of happiness for me. There is only one wish on my mind. When this day is through, I hope that I will find that tomorrow will be just the same for you and me. All I need will be mine if you are here.
The home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
For the BBC News at 5 o'clock, this is Richard Lawson. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the killing of the Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah has settled the score. He described his death in an Israeli airstrike on Beirut on Friday as a historic turning point. Iran, a key ally of Hezbollah, has declared a five-day mourning period and called for an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council. Our international editor Jeremy Bowen says the decisions taken over the next few days could determine whether the conflict spirals into a wider war, with Hezbollah damaged but not defeated.
It still has experienced fighters, it still has weapons. How the people who are there now after him decide to use those, what their allies in Iran decide to do, and the way Israel decides to try to follow up the success it's had so far. All that shorter term could lead to a wider Middle East war. Longer term, it could even reshape the region.
The Kent MP Rosie Duffield has resigned from the Labour Party because of what she called the government's cruel policies. In her resignation letter, she accused Sir Keir Starmer of hypocrisy for accepting gifts from donors while cutting winter fuel payments to millions of pensioners in England and Wales. There's been no response from Downing Street yet. Our correspondent Damian Grammaticus has more details.
Rosie Duffield told the BBC she believed Sir Keir Starmer cared more about greed and power than making a difference. Her resignation letter was deeply critical of the Prime Minister for his leadership, calling it uninspiring. His policy of cutting winter fuel support, saying it's cruel and unnecessary, and his accepting of gifts, calling it avarice off the scale. Speaking to Sunday with Laura Kunzberg, she said it was profoundly disappointing. There's no sign other Labour MPs plan to follow her. Reactions from them have ranged from regret she's gone to criticism that she had not already been suspended by the party.
Meanwhile, the Conservatives' annual conference will begin in Birmingham later today, where the focus will be on the party leadership contest. The four candidates will all use the conference to argue their case before two more are voted out of the race. Three people have